This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
European stocks are on a roll, but what about the real economy?
And Airbus spreads its wings and flies south. Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Monday, the 2nd of July. Today, the chairman of one of the biggest banks in Europe quits.
And later on the podcast, I'll talk with our regular contributor, Alan Sloan, about whatever schadenfreude he may feel when white-collar criminals get carted off to jail, plus a victory for the Seattle bag monsters. We'll tell you about it in a moment.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
The party that dominated Mexican politics for much of the last century is back in power. Enrique Peña Nieto of the Institutional Revolutionary Party has taken the presidency. Successful, and his opponents and supporters like to say strikingly handsome, Peña Nieto inherits an economy that's on the upswing.
The Institutional Revolutionary Party, known as the pre-controlled Mexico for 70 years, voters tossed it out in the year 2000 after years of corruption and economic crisis. Reporter Jennifer Collins is with me from Mexico City. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
So if the pre left such a bad taste in people's mouths last time around, why did Mexicans bring them back?
So you talk to people on the street here, and they think that Enrique Peña Nieto and his party will be able to improve the on-the-ground economy. I spoke with Claudia Jimenez at a polling station about why she voted for him.
I feel like he's going to create more jobs. For me, I think we're going to be more stable in every way.
That, of course, is her nod to the instability created by the drug war. Maybe you've heard of it.
Yeah. He's inheriting one of the most dangerous countries on the planet. At least it seems that way to Americans. Does Peña Nieto have a real plan?
Well, Peña Nieto says he's going to go after the violence instead of the outright battle with the drug cartels there is now. There's talk of beefing up police forces and improving intelligence to limit the guns and money coming back into the country. Carlos Ramirez of the Eurasia Group says those are all good ideas.
But I don't see a strong commitment from Peña to really tackle this problem.
And as long as it remains a problem, it's limiting economic growth, he says, by 1% of GDP. That's billions of dollars of tourism, investment, and transportation of legitimate exports to the U.S.
Should we expect any changes in Mexico's relationship with the U.S.?
So if anything, Peña Nieto wants to make the relationship even better. After all, we buy 3/4 of Mexico's exports, and U.S. visitors are the largest source of tourism. So many in Mexico will tell you they're hoping the violence subsides so more of those visitors return.
Jennifer Collins in Mexico City, thank you.
You're welcome.
European leaders last week took unexpectedly specific steps to put money into troubled Spanish banks and to buy Italian government bonds.
There are financial markets, and there are Europe's real economies. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has been looking into this. Mitchell, good morning.
Hi, David.
So before we get too captivated by stock numbers, how is the economy doing in Europe, the one, you know, that's supposed to be producing goods, services, maybe buying stuff from overseas?
Well, David, not all that well when you look at the underlying economy. Today there's a report that unemployment across the eurozone has hit 11.1%. That is bad. It's the highest since the single currency was established in 1999. And factory activity is slowing, not just in southern Europe, but in the more robust economies, France and Germany.
Euro countries are heavily dependent on each other for trade, clearly. But what about American companies? How much difference do you think does this weak set of European economies make here?
Well, Europe gets 20% of our exports, so it is an important market. And it's for high-end stuff. It's chemicals, transportation, computers, sophisticated machinery. This is exactly what's been helping to juice the U.S. recovery, such as it is, says economist Gregory Dacko at IHS Global Insight.
It's true that U.S. exports had been providing, you know, one of the few boosts to real GDP growth in the recent quarters. A lot will depend on how the European situation evolves. I would say that export growth is not falling off a cliff, but rather that it's going down a steep hill. But it's not time to panic yet.
Now, keep in mind, Europe will still be exporting plenty from the U.S., just not as much as it had been. The danger is that the slowdown will hit U.S. manufacturers, companies like Caterpillar, let's say, and then they could hold off on hiring, and that will make job growth even worse than it already is here.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman live. Mitchell, thank you.
You're welcome.
The European airplane maker Airbus announced today it'll spend $600 million on an assembly plant in Alabama. It's going to make the Airbus A320 there. Now, at first blush, Airbus in Alabama, Airbus in the United States for that matter, just doesn't quite fly. Here to talk it through, I've got Alan Michael. He's a professor of finance at Boston University School of Management. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why would Airbus want to build in Alabama?
Well, they'd like to build in Alabama for a number of reasons. They'd like to win more U.S. business, and in particular, getting defense deals. They lost a big defense contract about a year and a half ago for the U.S. Air Force for tankers. Defense is a big business for any airline producer. So they're very interested in competing with Boeing on the commercial front, competing with Boeing on the defense front.
Does it have anything to do with labor costs in the south of the U.S.?
I think that becomes certainly one issue. I don't think it's a decision that's made solely on labor costs, but labor costs don't hurt them. And it's more than just labor costs. It's labor inflexibility in Europe. When you take a look at producing a plant in Europe, you've got all kinds of labor restrictions. You can't close down that plant very easily. You can't make work rule changes very easily. Even with unions in the United States, it's much easier than in Europe. So there's a leg up that any manufacturer has producing in the United States.
But this seems crazy to me, and probably to lots of other people. Airbus is the European airplane maker. Weren't they founded to create airline building jobs for Europeans?
They were initially founded to create jobs over in Europe. But, you know, over time, things change. And now they realize that they're losing contracts because they aren't in the United States.
How can Boeing respond to something like this? I guess they're not likely to set up a plant in France, I suppose.
No, I don't think Boeing will set up a plant in France. I think Boeing understands that manufacturing in Europe is not a big winner. Boeing is probably going to have to retool its efforts at being more service-driven and cutting costs.
Finance professor Alan Michael at Boston University. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
Each Monday, for a look at the day's market, we turn to Julia Coronado, the senior U.S. economist at BNP Paribas, who joins us from New York. Julia, good morning.
Good morning.
Julia, I was looking through the data from the manufacturers there. Some growth, some, is implied here, I think.
That's right. The index is just above 50, which means that there is a growth in manufacturing output, but it is slower than it was earlier in the year.
Domestic demand, looking through that data, still okay. I suppose that is something to latch on to.
Yes, I mean, the U.S. has been doing relatively well. We've seen a slowdown in a lot of areas of the world, and the U.S. has also slowed down, not quite as much. But I think U.S. manufacturers are starting to feel the pinch of the global slowdown. We really have benefited a lot in the last couple of years from the boom in Asia, the boom in Latin America, and a much healthier European economy. Now, all of those things are more subdued, and that's affecting the U.S.
More subdued is right. This market outfit also surveyed the people who do the ordering at factories in Europe. And across the Eurozone, things are looking down, even in places like Germany.
That's right. The effects of all of the fiscal austerity and belt tightening are really being felt, even in Germany. So Germany had, like the U.S., been holding on much better than the rest. But now they are also being dragged down by the lack of demand in places like Italy and Spain. And those indexes have fallen deeply into negative territory. So they're really hurting in those southern European countries.
I don't know if you saw this news story also this morning. Reuters reporting that the private equity firm Carlyle Group is agreeing to keep Sunoco's big East Coast oil refinery from closing down as expected. I guess that could keep oil prices in the East from spiking again.
And that's been the good news for consumers lately. While there's been a lot of bad news, one of the rays of sunshine has been falling gasoline prices, which is a welcome development as we enter the summer travel season. So that's going to help keeping that refinery open, helps keep retail gas prices low, and helps keep consumers feeling a little bit better about things.
Julia Coronado, BNP Paribas, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
So, David, have you yet had the pleasure of visiting a Walmart Express?
I haven't been inside. Passed one recently, but not inside.
I haven't even had the pleasure of passing one. But apparently Walmart is experimenting with these smaller stores, including this thing sort of akin to a neighborhood market, they tell us, called a Walmart Express. The retailers rolled out most of these new stores in rural North Carolina, where fresh food options can be scarce. But Walmart Express faces competition from the corner dollar store. Here's North Carolina Public Radio's Leonida Inge.
We all pretty much know what a Walmart supercenter looks like. Aisles for days. Well, Walmart Express stores are only one-tenth the size of a supercenter.
How y'all doing today?
Good. Danielle Palmer manages the Walmart Express in tiny Snow Hill. It's one of five mini stores Walmart is piloting in North Carolina.
It's like, I feel like it was made for me. You know, it was back down home, very small, where I can really know every single one of my associates and every single customer that visits us on a daily basis.
Walmart Express stores are basically grocery stores with a pharmacy and a few extras. Serena Sturdivant shops here often.
I only just come just to get, like, when I got to get a couple of things. It's convenient, quick, easy. When
you just what did you get today?
Oh, french fries and chicken tenders and sugar. For the kids.
So we see this as an opportunity to come into this community and offer them not only affordable but healthy food options.
Ronnie Hayes is a regional VP for Walmart.
And let's face it today, I mean, with the gas prices and everything else, you know, I think our customers are going to appreciate that.
That sounds similar to the business model for chains like Dollar General and Dollar Tree. In fact, dollar stores have weathered the down economy better than Walmart. Kylie Rollins is VP of Communications for Family Dollar. She says they're not worried about Walmart Express.
We've operated stores for more than 50 years. And, you know, Walmart is certainly a formidable competitor and someone we always have to be aware of. They serve our customer.
So far, Walmart has opened fewer than a dozen Walmart Express stores. In the past, Walmart said it could open hundreds if this model does well. Right now, the company is tight-lipped on any expansion of Walmart Express. Meanwhile, Family Dollar is on a roll. Rollins says it's on track to open nearly 500 new stores this year. I'm Leonida Inge for Marketplace.
For the millions of Americans who live to regret the mortgage they got stuck with, consider this. When Bank of America bought troubled mortgage lender Countrywide, it seemed like a steal. 5 years later, Countrywide has cost B of A about $40 billion in home loans gone bad, settlements with states, legal fees. The Wall Street Journal today quotes a University of North Carolina finance professor calling the Countrywide purchase the worst deal in the history of American finance. Really? Hands down, the professor says.
So, David, are you feeling just a little teeny bit of jet lag or something maybe this morning? Maybe more than,
something's off.
Maybe,
you're right.
Maybe more than a little, since you're not normally in on this shift anymore.
You get that right.
We feel more than a little jet lag in these mornings. But for most folks, if you feel that, you can blame it maybe on the leap second that was added to the world's official time over the weekend. World timekeepers do that every so often to keep our atomic clocks in sync with the Earth's actual rotation. Sounds harmless, and it mostly is, but in computer code, every second really does count. A number of websites like Foursquare and Gawker had technical problems related to the adjustment over the weekend, and Qantas Airlines in Australia delayed hundreds of flights.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
Much of the coverage of campaign spending and the ads in the last couple of years is centered around big donors and money coming in from so-called super PACs. But one Mitt Romney supporter has used his money in a slightly different arena, maybe not arena, but the soccer field. It's really just the jerseys. He's paid FC New York, the football club in New York, a minor league soccer club on Long Island, to place Romney's name and campaign slogan, Believe in America, on the front of the team's jerseys.
Well, here to talk with us about this unusual campaign advertising in today's Midday Extra is Tony Kelso. He's a media studies professor at Iona College in New York. Hello, Tony.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. So everybody's been concerned with super PACs and how that kind of funding could change elections. So how dangerous, how insidious is this jersey advertising kind of thing?
Well, it is a big factor at large. But as far as this story that's just come out recently about the soccer team, I think it's just a blip on the map. If this donor was sponsoring, say, the Red Bulls or some major league soccer team, I think it might have some kind of an impact. But given that it's just a minor league team, they're not on television, I don't see what difference it's really going to make.
But what's going on with the soccer jerseys may be emblematic of something important, right, Professor? Campaigns have to get creative in trying to reach voters because voters aren't just sitting there watching TV like they did in the old days.
Well, that's true. That's true. You know, obviously we've always had the standard lawn signs and bumper stickers and so on, but they might be trying to find other space, you know, space out there in the culture to occupy, and certainly soccer uniforms is a new one.
Admittedly, not a lot of people in the grand scheme of things are going to see this actual team, but I'm just thinking about the implications of this. It's
right.
One thing to put up a billboard. It's another to sort of ask your supporters to wear a campaign button or something like that. It's quite another to pay to have your name and message put on the chest of a living, breathing, moving, soccer-playing human being who has no say in it, right?
That's true, but on the other hand, soccer is a sport unlike the other major sports in the United States where it's pretty much accepted that logos are going to be on the jersey. It's almost like race car driving. I mean, I wouldn't be that surprised to see politicians' names on race cars here eventually. And in a way, I almost look at it, I mean, I guess at this level, although it's a little bit more so than what I'm going to refer to, I sort of see it as sponsoring a little league team, you know, Joe's Pizza in the neighborhood.
But how much more evil would that be? I mean, you could put it on children, you know, but that's...
I think that might provoke some resistance, you know, from parents. I'm not sure there'll be much resistance to them wearing it on the soccer jerseys because I think, you know, the public at large is almost inured to this kind of thing.
Well, I think he should go the whole hog, this supporter of Mitt Romney. He should invite people in the famous style of radio stations past to get a suntan using a little cutout with the Romney name, and you can permanently suntan your presidential candidate onto your skin. Well, that would be a...
There you go. Well, I'll tell you, the human body has been used for consumer advertising. You know, they've used attractive women on the beach. They've used people just, you know, and not just, you know, the traditional sandwich board, but actually people out there that have got different sorts of haircuts or wearing certain different clothes. And
yeah, I think,
you know,
I'm with David. Let's go for it. Let's get some Obama teams and a whole lot of Romney teams. Let's have them play each other, and maybe people would actually give a rip about watching professional soccer in this country for a change.
There you go.
I thought you were going to say care about the presidential campaign, but that's another
benefits for everybody.
Right.
Right. Well, Tony Kelso is a professor at Iona College in New York. He's also co-author of The Encyclopedia of Politics, Media, and Popular Culture.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
So the brother of Bernie Madoff pleaded guilty on Friday, and he's looking at 10 years in prison. All the white-collar crime in the news lately seemed like good fodder for our regular date with Alan Sloan. He's Fortune Magazine's senior editor-at-large. Hello, Alan.
Good morning, Jeff.
So we're on the heels now of two high-profile insider trading cases, Rajaratnam and Gupta. And yet, we still have all this supposed malfeasance related to the financial crisis, right? So what I want to know is why these insider trading prosecutions, but hardly any other prosecutions of the big fish on Wall Street?
Well, because insider trading, it's clear what it is, and it's pretty easy to prosecute if you have the evidence, which the government has. The financial meltdown that led to the Great Recession, well, stupidity, greed, and overreaching, when last heard, were not criminal offenses. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear how hard the government tried to find other things to go after some of the big fish.
I'm really fascinated by this hazy line, as you just said. What's a criminal offense, right? With insider trading or anything else, what's illegal and what's just reprehensible? Even after all of this, how much of Wall Street, you think, still dances in that zone?
Well, you know, the question is, where is good analysis become insider trading? I have no idea. The question also of the big financial meltdown, the thing I would look at if I were the government would be to see if the financial reports that were issued by some of the stricken institutions before they went under were in fact bogus and misleading. That's the kind of stuff they got Enron for, things like that.
Do you join in the kind of schadenfreude when these titans get ruined and then carted off to jail?
Well, it depends who they are. I don't want to see just show prosecutions just to, you know, have human sacrifices to make people happy. But it is hard to believe that all of this bad stuff to the tune of trillions of dollars went on and nobody broke the law. But based, again, on what I've read, these guys were clearly guilty and they were cheating other people. That's supposed to be an offense. And apparently it still is, which is a good thing.
Fortune Magazine senior editor at large, Alan Sloan. Thanks as always.
My pleasure, Jeff.
It is now July, and Japan's solar industry is certainly embracing all the sunshine we're getting this time of year. Starting this month, the Japanese government will provide billions of dollars in subsidies to promote solar energy. This is a market, it turns out, open to all sellers, including American ones. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Japan's solar rush is on. Tokyo's new subsidy pays homeowners and companies a high price for generating and selling solar energy. Program lasts 20 years. How high a price? Double what the Germans pay. Triple the Chinese price. Nathaniel Bullard is with Bloomberg New Energy Finance.
With the Japanese market offering such generous terms right now, is the potential for a real boom.
He thinks Japan's market could leapfrog Italy's, for second largest in the world, behind China. For consumers, a big new market stirs innovation for the world. Bullard thinks in a decade, we'll build entire electricity systems from renewable sources. No grid.
The question will be, not where do I connect to a conventional grid of the sort that you find in the United States or Europe, but rather, do I connect at all?
For now, solar companies from Germany and China compete with domestic firms in Japan. But the Americans will follow into this booming market, land of the rising, you know. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The chairman of Barclays Bank in London resigned today. Normally, the comings and goings of the occasional bank board chairman are not all that interesting, but this might be a tip of something a bit bigger.
You see, last week, Barclays agreed to pay $450 million to settle allegations in Europe and the U.S. that it conspired to manipulate a key interest rate, something called LIBOR. Normally, that rate emerges from the market activity among a whole bunch of banks, but regulators on both sides of the Atlantic think banks like Barclays were working the system. Here with more is our London Bureau Chief Stephen Beard. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Jeff.
So Barclays chairman has resigned, although not the CEO. Is this supposed to bring an end to this episode for Barclays and everyone else?
Well, Barclays would like it to, but as you say, this is a non-executive chairman of Barclays. He doesn't have a role in the day-to-day running of the bank, although he says, the buck stops with me. A lot of people here say he's the fall guy. The buck should really stop with the chief executive, the CEO, an American guy called Bob Diamond. Not only does Diamond now run Barclays, he was running the investment banking arm of Barclays at the time this interest rate manipulation took place. So a lot of people here are calling for him to step down, among them the leader of the opposition Labour Party, Ed Miliband.
I think there needs to be a more general change of leadership, including the chief executive, Bob Diamond. But I don't think it's enough, because people just resigning isn't really getting to the bottom of what happened, who's responsible, and punishing those who did wrong.
The Barclays chief, Bob Diamond, faces a parliamentary committee on Wednesday, and he's going to get a pretty rough ride. Incidentally, several other big international banks are also under investigation. A couple of American banks, it's believed, are under investigation too.
Along with all this, we've got some humbling news today for British banks from a magazine called The Banker. It's put out its rankings of banks around the world, and at least in terms of profits, it shows just how far the European banking sector has fallen.
That's right. I mean, the British banks, their share of global banking profits have halved over the past 5 years. European, continental European banks are doing even worse. Of the 25 least profitable banks on the planet, 24 were European. Clearly, this has a lot to do with the debt crisis. Meanwhile, Chinese banks, on the other hand, continue to boom. Chinese banks accounted for only 4% of global profits 5 years ago. Today, they account for 30%.
Stephen Beard in London. Thank you.
Okay, Jeff.
Wall Street professionals often get criticized for thinking too short term, sometimes selling off a so-called investment a fraction of a second after buying it. So as a former history major myself, may I salute Michael Hartnett. He's chief global equity strategist at Bank of America. Hartnett's research report is called The Longest Pictures, in which he takes a deep dive into, among other things, how the British bond market performed during the American Revolution. How's that for the long-term time perspective? BusinessInsider.com looked at Hartnett's data and points out a spike in British interest rates at the signing of the Declaration of Independence, which makes sense when you actually think this through.
Yeah, I'm sure all those effects are still reverberating somehow in the financial markets of today, right?
Exactly.
Finally, it's the first weekday of a new fiscal year in many places, which means new laws go into effect today all around the country. In New York, for example, the Dignity for All Students Act makes a bullying-free environment a right for all elementary and secondary students. Among other things, every school has to appoint an anti-bullying coordinator.
Massachusetts adds transgendered people as a protected class in terms of the state's employment, housing, credit, and hate crimes laws.
Indiana bans smoking in all public places.
Arizona requires recycling for the first time for businesses, schools, and apartment buildings.
And in Seattle, single-use plastic bags become illegal. It's a victory for the bag monsters, advocates draped in plastic bags who promoted the ban on YouTube and elsewhere.
John, some people have developed toxic levels so high that they're becoming what's called a plastic bag monster, using their callous convenience as a way to make sure that every... Oh, Glenn! Glenn, get this! Wait, no!
Glenn!
Now, retailers are allowed to use up their existing inventory of plastic bags, and there are exceptions for things like flowers, dry cleaning, and takeout food. So, in other words, David, the bag ordinance still has a few holes in it.
I hate when that happens. I'm David Brancaccio in New York.
I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read,
Well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.